You turn to Marketplace for the latest news about what's happening in the economy and how it impacts you and your community. When you donate to support our nonprofit newsroom, you can also get something a little more tangible. We've got a great lineup of donor thank you gifts right now, a shrinkflation mini tote bag, water bottles, mugs, hats, and yes, the Kai PA glasses are back, but only while supplies last, and I'm taking some of them. Contribute any amount to make a difference and pick up one of these gifts. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Black gold takes a massive tumble. Black Friday seems a touch more sedate. And one artist catalogs her year of zero shopping. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 28th of November. It is good, as always, to have you with us. And we are going to start the show today, as we do most Fridays, with some live economic analysis of the week that was. And today I am joined by Felix Salmon, senior editor at Fusion. Welcome back, Felix.
Good afternoon, Lizzie.
I want to start, I'm going to start on the assumption that most people weren't paying rapt attention to the OPEC meeting in Vienna this week and may have been having Thanksgiving. But this was a very big deal because today, as we saw, oil fell 10%. Brent crude in London crossed the $70 a barrel market, basically because OPEC refused to make a production cut.
All of these big Middle Eastern oil producers, led by Saudi Arabia, are pumping out oil as fast as they can, pretty much, despite the fact that we seem to have this global oil glut, and that means that the price is falling. We are seeing the world of supply and demand proving itself again.
But I think this is counterintuitive for a lot of people, because if you are someplace like Saudi Arabia and you produce a lot of oil, you know, wouldn't you want less oil out there in order to make the price go up?
This is what OPEC was designed to do, is that when prices would fall, OPEC would reduce production, the price would go up, and then they would maximize the price that they would get for their oil, and they'd get rich. But now they're in competition with North Dakota and Canada and Argentina and all of these other places with shale oil, and what they are, and they're very worried that those places are going to be able to take over the global oil market. So what they're doing is they're driving the price of oil down to a point where it's not economic for those people to produce oil. Those people go out of business and then they're back in the driver's seat again.
What does that mean for us? What does that mean if you are a consumer on an individual level or on a country level? Maybe not the U.S., but another country.
In the short term, it's fantastic. It means cheaper gas. It means a boost to GDP. It means everyone's – it's essentially a tax cut because the price of oil is in everything we buy. And so we become richer. It's fantastic. In the long term, it means that all of those things become much more volatile, and it could even mean that long-term higher price of oil.
I'm going to switch you to Black Friday, but in sort of a macroeconomic mode. We have seen reports of a slightly more subdued Black Friday. There were Walmart protests, which we're going to talk about later on the show. There were some protests aimed at boycotts around Ferguson, but also just sort of a mood of less consumerism. Do we, you think, start to see any of that translate into weaker consumer spending and the macro economy?
No. No, Black Friday is a publicity stunt, and it's basically a way for the retail, you know, shops to try and remind us that Christmas is coming up and can we please go Christmas shopping. It doesn't – the amount of money that is spent today makes absolutely no difference to the total amount of money spent annually.
And yet, where would you gauge the health of the U.S. consumer? Because we get so many – inquiries, pieces of tape from listeners who say, gosh, it just doesn't feel good to me.
Well, that's why you have, you know, incredibly low interest rates in Europe and in the United States. That's why no one's raising rates, because everyone is feeling poor and we don't have full employment and it's taking a while to recover still 6 years later from the financial crisis. So, no, you're absolutely right. We're not seeing exuberance on the part of consumers, but I wouldn't say it's worse than last year.
Well, maybe we all just drive around for a while until the next OPEC meeting.
We're exuberant in terms of how far we can drive on a dollar of gas.
Felix Salmon, senior editor at Fusion, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Also, news broke this afternoon that former Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice won his appeal to the NFL and is now eligible to play for any team. He was indefinitely suspended in September for violating the NFL's so-called personal conduct policy. That was after a video was released of him punching his then-fiancée in an Atlantic City elevator. The punch knocked her unconscious. He then dragged her body out into a hallway. The question now is whether any team will sign him up. When we turn to the markets, another record high on the Dow. More details when we do the numbers. End of November doesn't just mean holiday shopping and leftover turkey. If you have a job with benefits, it also means the end of open enrollment. Gotta make choices about health insurance or flexible spending accounts or saving for retirement. And if you have the nagging feeling you're not doing enough, Marketplace's Dan Weissman has some news for you. You're probably right.
We're living longer, so our nest egg needs to last a longer time. Social Security and Medicare are both headed for shortfalls in the next 20 years, so it would be smart to think about benefit cuts as a risk factor. And the title of Andrew Estruth's new book tells you how we're doing with this challenge. He wrote it with his colleagues at the Boston College Center for Retirement Research. It's called Falling Short: The Coming Retirement Crisis and What to Do About It.
Roughly half of current workers are not participating in any kind of employer retirement plan at their current job.
The average household that's approaching retirement, ages 55 to 64, has just $111,000 socked away in retirement accounts. He looks up what that would buy you if you bought an annuity that's guaranteed monthly income.
You would get approximately
$500 a month.
If you take that $500 a month and combine it with your Social Security benefit, that's all most people have.
And the lower your income, the lower your total savings tend to be, if any. The center estimates that more than half of us will fall significantly short of what we'd need to have a standard of living in retirement that's like what we have now. Andrew Biggs does the math differently. He's with the American Enterprise Institute. He concludes that just a quarter of people will fall short. For instance, he says young adults may have different but not necessarily unwise financial priorities, like paying for school. And if keeping your standard of living is the yardstick, then he says people who are poor today have a different problem.
Your problem is not that you're not saving enough for retirement. Your problem is you're poor.
In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Lots of shoppers, as we've been mentioning, hit big box stores for Black Friday. But not everyone at Walmart was lining up for the deals. There were protests calling for higher worker wages at about 1,600 stores across the country, organized by a group called Our Walmart. And this is the third Black Friday they've done this. Marketplace's wealth and poverty correspondent Chrissy Clark joins me now. Hi, Chrissy.
Hey, Lizzie.
You covered these protests when they started 2 years ago. What's happened since then, if anything, really, in response to these?
So the main message of these protests has been about working conditions and pay. And in the last 2 years, Walmart has made some changes that have aligned with those demands. Walmart, of course, says they were not in response to the protests. They were things that they were discussing internally anyway. But correlation and causation aside, some of the changes that Walmart has made include things like a new online scheduling system that makes it easier for workers to pick up extra hours, which workers have responded to very positively. The company's also revamped its policy for pregnant workers, making it easier for them to qualify for light duties. And then Walmart's new CEO, Doug McMillon, came out saying that he wants to, quote, be in a situation where we don't pay minimum wage at all. Though that's certainly not the same thing as saying we're going to pay all our workers at least $15 an hour, which is what Walmart protesters have been calling for. But it is a signal that this is on their mind.
This is also part of a conversation about the broader economy. How does it fit into that conversation?
The larger issue is really that one of the fastest growing parts of our economy is in the low-wage service sector. And while the economy's finally started to see more job creation, the majority of those jobs are at the very bottom of the wage scale. And so for the last few decades, wages have been stagnating. And that's a really big part of why our economy is still sluggish. Our economy is driven by consumer spending. When wages are stagnating or low for a lot of people, people are spending less.
We saw four states raise the minimum wage after referendums and different votes in the midterm elections, but there doesn't seem to be much movement on the federal level to do the same thing.
Right. So voters in Alaska, in Arkansas, Nebraska, and South Dakota all approved ballot measures to raise their state's minimum wages, none as high as $15, but raise them. And those states, you may notice, are red states. So that suggests to some that maybe there are seeds for some bipartisan agreement on the federal minimum wage issue and raising it. Of course, some economists say, given how widely the cost of living varies in different parts of the country, it makes sense to just stick to it, doing it piecemeal at a local level, because it makes sense to have minimum wages that are set based on cost of livings in specific areas.
And when you look at this at the national level, the Congressional Budget Office also found that if you were to go to, say, a 10-10 minimum wage, that could also, in this economy, result in some fairly significant job losses, you know, offset in some part by higher wages. But that points to some real tension here.
Right. And that is sort of the fundamental balancing act that economists have been debating for a long time. Some economists say raising wages at the bottom will put more money in people's wallets. That will kickstart the economy. Others warn that could lead to fewer jobs as employers try to cut costs. So it's, you know, it's sort of a balancing act.
Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Coming up.
The problem is, we don't think about it because it's not a lot of money, right? Like, you can buy almost anything you want for a very cheap price on the internet these days.
So what if, instead, you just didn't? But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks ended the month mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was flat-ish, closing today at 17,828, a new record. The NASDAQ gained 4 points, 0.1%, to end at 4791. The S&P 500 slipped 5 points, 0.25%, to close at 2067. For the week, the Dow rose 0.1%, the NASDAQ gained 1.7%, and the S&P added 0.2%. OPEC's decision to keep oil pumping and let prices fall produced even more winners and losers. Losers, oil producers. ExxonMobil was down 4%, Chevron 5.4%, Marathon 5.8%. Winners, big fuel consumers, American Airlines up 8%, Southwest Airlines 6%, United Continental 8%. European markets were flattish too. France's CAC 40 rose 0.1%, Germany's DAX added less than 0.1%, Britain's FTSE was unchanged, bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.17%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. Now's the time to get all of your holiday shopping done. No waiting in line, just a click of a button. It's Cyber Monday. But you might want to know what not to buy your kids this Christmas. The U.S. Public Interest Research Group releases its list of dangerous toys. And on this day in 1982, the King of Pop, Michael Jackson, releases album Thriller. Cue the zombies. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. These days, automakers have robots to build their cars, but those robots need someone to keep them running. Toyota is one company trying to reshape the perception of maintenance jobs. Turns out you don't need a bachelor's degree to fix those robots. Emily Hanford of American Radio Works reports.
This is the factory floor of the Toyota plant in Georgetown, Kentucky, where in the short span of 20 hours, a huge ball of steel is transformed into a Camry or an Avalon or a Venza. Every year, this factory produces 500,000 cars and SUVs. A new one rolls off the line every 54 seconds. How? Robots, for one. But like all machines, robots break down. And finding people who can fix them is a challenge, says Toyota's Dennis Dio Parker.
We can't just go out and throw some ads and hire some skilled people. They're not out there.
Manufacturers across the country are facing the same problem. In a 2011 survey, three-quarters of executives at U.S. manufacturing companies said a shortage of skilled production workers was having a significant impact on their company's ability to expand.
Part of the problem is maintenance is not seen as a real sexy career.
Another part, says Toyota's David Cox, is kids today are being told they have to go to college. But colleges aren't turning out graduates with the kinds of skills a lot of employers need. That's why Toyota, in partnership with 15 other manufacturers in need of skilled workers, has set up its own two-year degree program.
Right now, I'm in my motors control class, really my electricity side of the program.
Students like Dalton Ballard are learning to be advanced manufacturing technicians, or AMTs. They're the ones who fix the robots. Classes take place at Toyota in a 12,000-square-foot classroom with equipment to teach things like fluid power and motors and controls.
So you can see where the wires, this is our power supply, which is 24 volts DC.
Ballard has his hands inside a metal box full of blue wires. He's learning to install a switch. Technical skills are a big focus of this program, but students take general education classes too, including math, humanities, and public speaking.
As you all know, your demonstration speeches start next week, so you all got your outlines back for that last class session.
The AMT program is a partnership with a local community college, but all courses are chosen or designed by Toyota. Ballard wasn't sure at first why he needed to learn public speaking skills.
But I really use them a lot now. Instead of just being like, oh, that part moves and that one extends a little bit, now I can actually explain it.
Along with taking classes, students do paid internships. After they graduate, they typically get hired full-time. Starting pay for advanced manufacturing technicians can be as much as $80,000 a year with overtime. Emily Houston, who always assumed she'd get a bachelor's degree, actually quit the University of Kentucky to do the AMT program instead.
I just kind of decided it wasn't so much about the degree as it was about the job that I was going to get with that degree.
Toyota has AMT programs in 7 states, including Kentucky. The program here got off to a slow start in 2010, but in the last year alone, the number of students has grown from 16 to more than 40. Houston, who has an internship at 3M, expects to get a full-time job when she graduates this spring. And because 3M is a global corporation,
I could get on full-time here and then transfer to another plant in California or in France.
Houston says she's always wanted to travel and once thought getting a bachelor's degree would be the way to do it. But it turns out knowing how to fix robots might be just as good. I'm Emily Hanford for Marketplace.
If you are still on an eating binge, I want you to think about cheese now. The French eat a lot of it, especially camembert. So you wouldn't think there was a French cheese crisis. But what connoisseurs consider to be real French cheese, the stuff made from raw, unpasteurized milk, is being produced less and less. The BBC's John Lawrenson has more from the camembert-making region of Normandy in northern France.
The sound of a camembert cow licking a microphone. These cows, when they're not tasting recording equipment, eat a lot of green Normandy grass and produce a lot of creamy milk that goes to make cheese that's admired the world over. But that heritage is disappearing.
La galette des Monts d'Or, le dauphin.
Véronique Richer-Lerouge, president of the Real Cheese Association, lists some of the cheeses that are now extinct. She's the author of a book entitled France, Your Cheese is Going Down the Drain.
In France, you had 100%. All cheese was raw milk cheese. And now we have 10%. And tomorrow it will be less and less. So you imagine what we are losing in 10 years, 20 years. It's really fast to destroy it.
Madame Richer-Lerouge says the supermarkets and big dairy companies are to blame. The former prefer pasteurised milk cheese because it has a longer shelf life, the latter because it's so much cheaper to make. Which doesn't stop them buying out traditional cheesemakers, keeping the name but changing the cheese. As Lactalis, the company that now makes three-quarters of French camembert, did with a famous camembert called Le Petit. The oldie-woldie label is the same. The only indication that it's no longer a raw milk cheese is in small print on the bottom of the box. Lactalis said they had no one available for interview and didn't reply to the written questions we sent them, which is a shame, as I'm sure they have some good arguments, in particular that if so many people buy pasteurised milk cheese, it's maybe because they like it.
The smell is very attractive. You want to bite in it, and yeah, the texture.
If that's the case, France's cheese cognoscenti believe French consumers have lost the plot.
There's a sort of a bitterness, but in a good way, a slight sting, together with the grass and the flour taste. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At Tout un Fromage, his shop in Rambouillet, west of Paris, Ludovic Bizot enthuses about an Alpine cheese called Abondance, a raw milk cheese like almost every cheese he sells.
Some pasteurized cheeses are very good, but if you compare the same cheese made with or without raw milk, then there is a difference, and raw milk is better. For a simple reason that pasteurizing the milk kills a number of living organisms that give the flavor.
Monsieur Bizot is worried that the young generation doesn't share the love of cheese that older French people have. But he's optimistic, nevertheless.
There's a revival of some ancient cheeses that some local farmers knew about or find documents about, and then they sit together and decide to make it again. Wow. And so we have a few reborn cheeses.
Wow.
Jesus is reborn, like Jesus.
In Paris, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
You are just over consumerism today. An alternative is don't buy anything at all. That's what cartoonist Sarah Lazarevic did for one whole year. Instead of buying the things she wanted but didn't need, she painted them. Her new book, A Bunch of Pretty Things I Did Not Buy, chronicles that year and includes the art she made along the way. Sarah Lazarevic, welcome to Marketplace.
Thanks for having me.
What made you so attracted, do you think, to writing about and illustrating our relationship with stuff and with buying stuff?
I think it started, like, I did that essay that kind of went viral on the Hairpin, and it was about just not shopping for a year, which always is the thing that grabs headlines. But plenty of people have done that before, and to me, it's frankly not very interesting. Lots of people go on shopping diets. What I really wanted to explore was, you know, how did I get here? How did I become the kind of person who had to make a moratorium on shopping? Because I don't consider myself a shopaholic. I never even thought I cared that much about going to stores. I hated them all. So it was sort of, I wanted to find some insights for myself as to why, you know, a preoccupation with things had become such a part of my life.
So you stopped shopping for a year. Did you save money in that time, or was it about something else?
For me, it's not so much the money. It's the fact that consumerism has become so mindless. And the problem is we don't think about it because it's not a lot of money, right? Like, you can buy almost anything you want for a very cheap price on the internet these days. I found that I was, you know, buying obscure, quirky things, but I was still buying stuff. And I didn't notice that I was swimming in money at the end of my year of no shopping. It was more that I hadn't wasted 2 hours looking at vintage bracelets that I didn't need. So if that makes any sense.
You have some rules in the back of your book for better shopping that I find kind of fascinating. I'm flipping through them. You can probably hear me flipping through them. Tell me about those.
I just felt there needed to be a bit of a takeaway because people often forget that they have, they forget that they already have something. Like my husband forgot that he needed a fall coat for about 2 years, and he forgot that he actually bought one at the end of last season. So I think people just also need to go look at their closets and organize, remember what they actually do have before they set out to buy stuff. Buying should be the last step. So if you can see if you already have it, you can borrow it. If you can
swap. Then thrift.
Yep.
Then make. And at the very, very top, buy.
Yeah.
There's a great bit in your book about minimalism, which often seems like it's this way of simplifying your life. You're only going to have this one kind of shirt, this one kind of pants, one kind of shoes. That seems to go awry for you.
You know, thrifty people tend to save things because I always save stuff thinking, oh, I can use this pot. I'll put it in my basement.
I can use this later.
I'll figure out something to do with it. And I know that's a trap we fall into, but I think the minimalists are always people who have tons of money because to be a minimalist, you have to be able to say, oh, I don't have anything in this beautiful, beautiful empty loft, but if I need it, I can always buy it at the drop of a hat. People, especially people who try to sell us things under the pretense of minimalism, like just buy this one perfect thing that's so beautiful, you'll never need another one perfect thing again. I guess I was just trying to say, be mindful of that.
So where are you now in your kind of relationship with stuff? I mean, what was the last thing you bought?
I bought a new backpack. I had my old backpack that I bought on eBay and it was falling apart. And I did put in my time to make sure I got one I liked and I think will last for years upon years.
Sarah Lazarevic is the author of A Bunch of Pretty Things I Did Not Buy. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the show today. Turns out Jackie Chan movies are the key to the solar energy business. Sort of. Researchers at Northwestern University used the material in a Blu-ray disc of Chan's movie Police Story 3, Supercop, to make solar panels that are 22% more efficient than the regular ones. Now, don't actually need a Jackie Chan movie. Any Blu-ray disc will apparently work, but it's just more fun to pretend you do. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace for today. Today, the Dow edged up to a new record, 17,828. The NASDAQ gained 4 points, 0.1%. The S&P slipped 5 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore and is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Kai Rizdahl is back Monday. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.